The relationship between the native population and the resource of the land and sea is so close that an entire culture is reflected.
I share what's on my table with you. When I share with you, then my heart is happy, so is yours. And this is the way of subsistence, way of life.
Subsistence means more to Alaska natives than hunting and harvesting. It is an intricate bond between people and the land that continues today. As this ancient way of life changes, it faces an uncertain future. In this program, Alaska natives tell what subsistence means to them and why it is essential. This is Holding Our Ground.
Funding for Holding Our Ground is provided by the Alaska Humanities Forum, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Rural Alaska Community Action Program, the North Slope Borough, and Zients Pertl Law Firm.
I never heard the word subsistence until 1971 under the Native Land Claims Act. Before that time, when I was brought up in the culture of my people, it's always been our culture and our land.
The word may be new, but to John Solomon, chief among the Gwich'in people of the Yukon Flats, subsistence reaches back thousands of years to spiritual beliefs, community traditions, and survival skills.
Subsistence living was not only a way of life, also a life-enriching process.
Nelson Frank.
Conservation and perpetuation of subsistence resources was part of the way of life and was mandated by the traditional law and customs. The traditional law was passed from generation to generation intact through the repetition of legends and observance of ceremonials which were largely concerned with the use of land, water, and resources contained therein.
Those same kinds of traditions and skills were learned among the Siberian Yupik Eskimos on windswept St. Lawrence Island. Edna Apatiki learned many skills the traditional way.
I am so thankful that I have knowledge I gained from listening. That was my way of education for my family. We were first naturalists, scientists, environmentalists, natural healers, conservationists, survivors, and philosophers, and many more, way before non-natives who studied to acquire our skills. We have our own ethnicity and knowledge and conscience of what we see as reality as native people.
That reality includes a subsistence economy which is not easily understood by outsiders. Canadian Judge Thomas Berger visited over 60 communities around Alaska, and he listened to hundreds of descriptions of village life. Berger says, without listening, one has few clues to the complex bond between people and the land.
When a white stranger visits a village in Alaska for a short time, he can no more recognize the subsistence economy on which based than a village person entering a major city for the first time can understand how its economy can work. The stranger to the village will see only the equipment for subsistence: snowmobiles, skiffs, nets, sleds, snowshoes, oil drums, and so on. And, of course, the products of subsistence, racks of drying fish, skins being scraped, smokehouses full of meat. He might guess that the villagers are busy because he would probably find very few of them at home.
Villagers usually travel with the seasons to gather and prepare their food. The harvest is different in every part of Alaska, but the work is always demanding.
In Eskimo way of life, getting food was a daily effort. It had to be done every day. It could be bad weather, could be a nice day, but it was an everyday effort that the Eskimo had to go out and gather his own food, so he could survive.
Just like, you know, making an earning. Like a white man works, he makes his earning, he feeds his family. The native people, for a long time, have survived from the land. It's just like having a job. That's what they know, and they can teach it to their kids.
Jasper Joseph and Michael Okovac Sr. live in western and southwestern Alaska villages, where salmon runs mean constant work at summer fish camps. In the Arctic village of Allakaket, near the Brooks Range, people like Linda Dunton are also at work.
In the springtime, we had our spring camps where we hunt ducks and got the fish in the springtime and the muskrats, and then to another place later in the summer to go fishing for salmon. And in the fall time, you go to another place to get your moose and set up your camp for the winter.
My people, in summertime,
Michael Hunt of Kotlin,
they go out to their fish camps, they put up fish for the winter time, make dry fish, and they put them away in the barrels. They do their subsistence way of life, and then they go out and pick salmon berries, prepare for the winter as their subsistence. And in winter time, they put our sea fish nets out and put out blackfish traps.
The cycle of seasons demands different skills throughout Alaska's rugged terrain. Spring is a time of renewal and celebration. In Southeast, the Haida people celebrate the return of the salmon, which means more than a time to fish.
In the spring months, when the salmon return home,
Woodrow
first
Morrison.
Ones, when we see them jump, we holler, Ayo! Ayo! That's a celebration. Our relatives have returned again. Creator is making it possible for us to continue life in that same cycle.
Lucy Westlock from Amonik.
In the springtime, we hunted and gathered food from the tundra, including mouse food, which are special roots gathered underground. We gather food from the lakes, the plants that grow there. We gather wood from the area to cook our food. I'm still practicing those things that I practice to get food for my children.
The climate is harsh, but the land provides food, clothing, shelter, and even transportation. Judy Bauman of Fairbanks remembers a gift her great uncle made.
When I was young, my great uncle came to live with us, and he asked my mother, what would you like me to make for you? And she said, I'd like a dog sled. And he went outside and chopped some trees down, and he didn't even use the electric drill. He showed me how he made it with a stick with a nail on the end of it and a little bowl, and he put it in his mouth, and he moved that bowl, and it would drill a hole. He made everything that he worked on that sled with, he made everything that he used from nothing. I mean, he could go out 96 years old, he'd go out in the woods and he could make whatever he wanted to. He didn't have to go to the store and buy anything.
People living in coastal communities depend largely on marine life for subsistence foods. Alice Kaloi lives in Gamble on the northwest tip of St. Lawrence Island. Much of her food comes from the Bering Sea.
We, as St. Lawrence Islanders, are just like those farmers on the outside. We eat from the plants of the sea, just like farmers eat from their farm. We collect the plants that grow on the water, and we collect them when they are washed up on the shore.
The Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea are our gardens.
For Jonah Tokiana, the bounty of those gardens is the great bowhead whale. People along the Arctic coast hunt bowheads two times a year. Alice Solomon describes in her Inupiaq language how traditional whaling boats are made in the spring.
The hunters who catch bearded seal, the women prepare the skin, cuts it up, butchers it, and this is the role of the woman. And when they return, she takes care of them, working very hard because there's so many skins that have to be put together into a boat to make a boat.
In recent years, aluminum boats have been used, but some hunters still prefer bearded seal skin. For centuries, the people of the Arctic coast have depended on the whale for survival. They know its migration and behavior patterns. Burton Rexford is a member of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. He says a whaling captain relies on the knowledge handed down from generations of experience.
A whaling captain is faced with great responsibilities. His number one priority is, of course, the immediate concerns of safety while out on the hazardous and icy Arctic waters. It is his knowledge and preparation that the people depend upon for their daily food. If a village did not catch a whale, then we knew beyond the shadow of the doubt that we would experience extreme hardship and feared the oncoming hunger that would strike us. We knew that when we caught a whale, we would then be able to sleep easily and eat well.
On the first day of a whaling festival, the people traditionally bring the whaling captain's boat ashore, and all the people are fed, including those unable to take part in the hunt. No one goes hungry, because sharing is a strong part of the tradition.
The people are happy. They're smiling. They're excited. And you think about it. Boy, they caught a whale. They get really excited. And it goes all the way, the happiness extends all the way from the deep inside. And when you go into the house that caught a whale, that happiness, that excitement, that crying for joy, and because they are glad that they have been given that gift.
Laurie Kinnick of Point Hope.
We, the Inupiaq people, have always shared and divided our food, and that is our way of life. We have practiced our whaling traditions, and we are still using them today. When they catch one whale, everybody in Point Hope has a share of the muktuk, the whale, and everybody is fed.
Joe Hotch is a Tlingit from the southeast community of Klukwan.
Klukwan interpreted in Tlingit means always a community. We share our subsistence foods with one another.
It's more than food, it's the ingestion of the spirit of that animal also, or that fish.
Woodrow Morrison.
And also those fish and the other game. are a gift that was given to us. And therefore, when any person would come into my house and I had fish, I had meat, whoever came in was also entitled to that. And so we give to each other. People never kill anything. They go out and they catch a moose. They don't go out and kill a moose. They catch some birds. The animal has a spirit of its own. And many times, old way, people would say to that animal after they had shot it, "I thank you for giving up your spirit so that my family could live." And then we would treat it with respect.
The Gwich'in people of the Yukon Flats pay this same respect to the caribou.
The caribou, as my people believed for many years, is part of the Gwich'in people religion.
Jonathan Solomon.
We eat it. We use their parts of their fur and stuff for our own clothing. But we also believe that the population of the Gwich'in people in the Yukon Flat goes up and down with the numbers of these animals. This is why it's very important to us when we talk about the porcupine caribou herd, that it be protected for our generations to come, because this is our belief. We are not a visitor upon these lands. We are in the same ecosystem as the animal on these lands.
Whether it's caribou, seal, or salmon, people are always aware of future needs. Bonnie McCord of Tyonek.
The people down here know how much fish they have to take for the year to carry themselves through the winter. We've been taught that by our elders. So we never take any more from the sea or the land than what we can use.
Further north on the Koyukuk River, Wilson Sam of Huslia uses the same principles when he hunts.
My parents always used to say, make sure you try to get the male if you're going to go out and get a bird. Don't try to get the female, because they take care of the eggs and then they have the young ones. So make sure you get the male. That's the way you preserve your country.
We hold in trust for our children.
Antoinette Homer.
The youth of Mother Earth's garden. If we do not tend to our garden with nurturing strokes, she will not produce for our survival. That is the supreme law.
Nurturing strokes are no longer enough. Few people are living exclusively from the land. The land-based economy is now mixed with a cash economy. It takes several hundred dollars to pay for transportation, ammunition, motorboats, and other supplies, whether the hunt is successful or not. But money is hard to come by in most villages because there are few regular jobs. The village school, post office, store, and sometimes local government employ a handful of people. Fishing, firefighting, and occasional construction provide temporary cash-paying jobs, but people still depend on the land for many basic needs. Sheila Agatherio lives on Kodiak Island.
Our economic stability in villages is very bad. The unemployment is extremely high. There's no place else in the United States and maybe in the world where you're going to find such unemployment statistics as you will in villages. I look out here in the bays. We go out there and we fish. We go out among the bays and we hunt. We get our food there. We depend on the food that we get for ourselves.
Anuska Petla estimated the cash value of that food. She presented her findings to Judge Thomas Berger when the Alaska Native Review Commission visited the village of New Stoyahawk.
All the meat and all the fish
that we eat every year per household, it would come to about $6,000 to $7,000, and I know you, most of us can't afford it because there's not enough jobs in the villages for everyone.
Are hunting and fishing important here?
Andrew Kelly of Amonok.
That question shouldn't even be asked. Without hunting and fishing, we cannot live. We cannot expect to feed our family.
Village stores and social services have provided a few basic needs that used to come only from the land. There are fewer subsistence activities in some villages. These developments have not reduced the importance of subsistence, according to Judge Thomas Berger.
Even in villages where subsistence activities appear to have declined, people speak of subsistence with the same passion as they do in villages where it is flourishing. In Alaska, native societies, large and small, were erected on a subsistence base. Today, subsistence gives continuity to village life, and Alaska natives still regard subsistence as their birthright. Even those not engaged in subsistence regard it as essential to their future well-being.
Urban dwellers living in a cash-based economy might supplement their store-bought foods with fresh-caught fish and game. It is the other way around for those who live mainly in a land-based economy, where cash is a supplement. According to Antoinette Homer of Craig, subsistence living is not a matter of choice, it is a necessity.
Living off the land and sea is not only traditional, but owing to the scarcity of cash income, it is required for our families to survive.
Gladys Durendoff of Huslia.
I'd like to quote this one Eskimo lady. She said, if we ever lose our subsistence ways, the older people, they wouldn't be able to eat store-bought food. They're so used to living on seal oil. And she said that if they don't get to have seal oil and things like that, you know, they'd probably die early or something. And she also said that seal oil is, you know, the blood of their life, she said.
Congress abolished subsistence rights in 1971 as a part of ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. In 1980, Congress passed a lands bill called ANILCA that appeared to restore some of those rights. But the state maintains control of most fish and wildlife species. Permits are required in areas where people once hunted freely. The Land Claims Act also reduced the land area to about one-tenth of the traditional size. ANCSA gave those lands to corporations, although Alaska Natives can hunt exclusively on this corporate property. The state of Alaska still sets the seasons and the limits.
Those laws,
Judge Berger,
coming from a different tradition, have the effect of undermining the native society founded on subsistence, because those laws don't take into account the fact that there is a whole web of moral and spiritual and economic relationships founded on subsistence that a whole society depends on. So it seems to me that the issue of subsistence is not one of competition for resources, not simply a question of allocation of resources. It is rather an issue of a different order of magnitude, the survival of Village Alaska.
Berger has urged Native peoples to take control of subsistence resources as much as possible. Traditional laws could then be implemented. Former director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, Marie Adams.
There are traditional subsistence laws within the communities. I mean, they have their own laws, basically their own structure on how they hunt, what is acceptable, what is not. And what's been happening the last several years, several decades, is with the new federal government, the state government coming in and
basically imposing laws without clearly understanding or going out to see what is out there has created a lot of confusion. Many times we've had to clarify what is meant by which law.
State subsistence laws have already been tested. A statewide vote preserved rural priorities for fish and game in 1982, but new court challenges and pressure from urban hunters is again forcing the subsistence way of life into another heated political battle. Kotzebue High School student Bobby Wells.
I remember our fathers, our forefathers, how they survived in this world, in strong winds, in cold temperatures, because they knew how to survive. They were taught to share. They were taught to help each other for thousands of years. And today, we are in this same situation, but this time we're not surviving against nature. We're in a time where we're searching, we're fighting to survive among different people in this Western civilization.
When the United States tried to stop bowhead whale hunting in 1977, whaling captains in northern Alaska formed the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. Marie Adams recalls what happened in Barrow.
People were deeply hurt when they were asked to stop whaling. It was incomprehensible. I remember listening to the meeting and listening to it, people were very upset. Men and women were all crying after the Whaling Commission got together. One of the things that we ran across were people did not believe that we were still whaling traditionally the way we were and still carrying on the traditions that we did.
The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission finally prevailed. Their management plan is now recognized by U.S. government and several foreign nations. Alaska natives have also created management plans to regulate caribou, walrus, and migratory birds. Later in this series, we look at how people view the state, federal, and traditional laws that affect subsistence, the political challenges, and what Alaska natives are doing to manage subsistence resources. Please join us. For Holding Our Ground, this is Adeline Raybaugh. This program is produced by Jim Sykes, written by Jeff Berliner, edited and researched by Sue Burris. Mary Kansiewicz is our script consultant. Special thanks to the community of Gamble for dancing and singing, and also special thanks to the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. For more information about this and other programs in this series, write to Western Media Concepts, P.O. Box 215, Anchorage, Alaska, 99510. Holding Our Ground is a production of Western Media Concepts, which is solely responsible for the content.
Funding for Holding Our Ground is provided by the Alaska Humanities Forum, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Rural Alaska Community Action Program, the North Slope Borough, and Zients Pertl Law Firm.